Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Friday, May 21st, 2010, I am delighted to be welcomed by Dr. Mark Smith, Chief Social Scientist at Connected Action Consulting Group. Welcome, Mark.
Jennifer, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
I am so thrilled we have a doctor on the program. It's very exciting. You're our first sort of official doctor on the show. And, you know, I wanted to give folks a little bit of background. You do basically mapping, and there's probably a better way of saying this, but mapping influence in real time on the net. Isn't that true?
I think for many people that would describe what I'm trying to do. We have created several tools that extract data from social networks on the web, social media networks, and this tool then makes it easy for non-programmers to draw maps that guide them to some people rather than others in those maps, and it guides them to those positions, to those people, because they occupy strategic positions within that, what we would call a graph or a network.
Right. And so give me some examples, or, you know, I've seen some of the examples, so maybe give the audience some examples of how that plays out and what they would see potentially.
Okay. Well, I have put up a number of these examples on my Flickr feed, so if people go to the web and look for images that were generated with the name of the tool, and that is NodeXL, N-O-D-E, letter X, letter L. NodeXL is the Network Overview Discovery and Exploration add-in for Excel. It's a free and open application. It plugs into Excel 2007, 2010. And I've been making a number of these maps myself and putting them on the Flickr feed so that others could get a sense of, well, what do you do with social media network analysis? And an example might be an image I generated today. There's a conference in Silicon Valley about the social graph. It's called the Social Graph Symposium. And so I built a map of the word social graph. It's, if you will, a social graph of social graph. It's the social graph. And what it shows you is when you turn this on, it'll chew through some data. In this case, we went to Twitter to get people who had mentioned the word social graph. And if you go to search.twitter and type in social graph, you'll get a series of tweets that contain that string. And that's great. It is very useful. The value of the map is to raise the question and to try to answer, are any of these tweets, quote, more important than others? Are any of these people more in the center of the population of people who mention social graph, more at the center than others? And so imagine a screen in which you'll see the profile photos, the images of the faces of, let's say, the several hundred people who have recently mentioned social graph. And then we'll make the pictures larger or smaller based on some attribute of their behavior. In this case, I made it based on how many followers they have. And that's a very traditional notion of importance, that it's just a unitary scale. You just, you know, somebody who has 1,000 followers is important, 2,000 followers more important. Network theory calls that a little bit into question, and it says conceivably somebody with just 2 followers could be even more important. And it raises that possibility by realizing that people occupy a location, a position. And so it's been said that in real estate there are 3 most important things, and they are location, location, location.
Location.
Yeah. In network theory, it's position, position, position. And so imagine the role of a person who is, quote, a bridge, the only path or the only connection between 2 otherwise separate groups. Maybe they only have 2 connections, but they're the only path between those 2 groups. Network theory lets us realize that could be really important. That could be valuable. And it allows us to see that just the raw count of followers might not be the only measure of importance. So what would you see? You'd see this map. There are all these profile photos. They're scattered around the screen, and they're of varying size. But then for any two of them, there may be a line that connects them. And that line might represent, I follow you, or I reply to you, or I even mention you. And there are other kinds of connections, but these are the three that our tool generates right now. And what you'll quickly see is that some people have a lot of lines, and some people don't. And that's only one measure of it. But I'm sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, so, you know, thinking about, you know, the way that this can influence companies and how they, like particularly let's take an industry such as public relations or certain marketers, even social media, as you mentioned, the followers as in the example that you know, initially. You know, this is something that, you know, many have tried, you know, kind of to do, and yet you've been working on this for obviously long enough to create an application and to be giving talks about this at Stanford and elsewhere. How did it come about that you have used your skills to create this sort of mapping or charting of influence or importance around topic areas?
First, I should note I am a sociologist, so I went to school and studied just basic sociology. Not everybody is familiar with what the domain of sociology is, but it's essentially wherever two or more people interact, that's the domain of sociology. It's all the way up to populations or whole planets of people. Mm-hmm. So far, we're only studying the one planet. I want to be clear on that. We're not doing extraterrestrial sociology yet. But it's about collective action. It's about how groups of people interact, and a sub-area of sociology is something called social network analysis, SNA. And SNA has been around, actually, for over 80 years, since about 1934, when Jacob Moreno, a professor at NYU, came to the United States, and he started working on what he called psychological geography. It later became sociometry and changed name again in the 40s and 50s, and it became social network analysis. So this is a tradition that is decades old in the social sciences. What's new, of course, is computation, the availability of it at large scale and low cost. And another thing that is new is the fact that human beings are now authoring their social relationships in a machine-readable form. I send you mail, and you can see, or my machine can see, I replied to you. I go to Facebook, and I become your friend, and there is a machine-readable edge or connection or tie there in which I am friends with you. In Twitter, I follow you. In Flickr, I am your contact, but I also might tag your photo. I might like it or favorite it. All of these things are what we would call ties. They're connections. Social network analysis is the tool or the toolkit for the analysis of collections of connections. And there's a lot of math you can do to a bucket of ties. And some of that math, I think, has been interpreted to be a way of calculating influence. And I'll actually take some exception to the word influence. I'd like us to actually leave this conversation thinking that the word influence is, woefully inadequate to capture all the things that social network theory can tell us about how people can occupy positions that are, if not unique, perhaps rare, and more important, strategic. So I guess one way of thinking about it is there's lots of kinds of influence, and let's not limit ourselves to just one. How did we get this far? Well, for a sociologist, I also really like computing, and I've been driven for many years by a desire to visualize social media, that calculating numbers about it can be very useful. But for my approach, I'm very interested in the intuitions that come when humans who are perhaps non-algorithmic, they don't program, get to play with data. And so we've built this tool that really requires no coding. As a matter of fact, there's no place for you to write a single line of code in using this tool. If you know how to make a pie chart in Excel, you're probably 10 minutes away from building a social network graph in Excel if you've added Node Excel. So our goal is really network analysis for the masses, for the rest of us.
Well, I wouldn't consider you probably the rest of us, but I get where you're going. I'm wondering, you know, in terms of, you know, where you work and what you do every day, you know, obviously you have a consulting group. What kinds of work are you doing? I mean, who's approaching you and going, you know, because I think that this is, you know, an area where so many people think it's not happening, but clearly there's an entire aspect of you know, of sociology that has taken this on, right? Not necessarily in terms of visualization, but in terms of the analysis piece anyway, and looking at the new opportunities that social media allows in terms of, you know, letting us explore how, you know, how connected we are and you know, again, what that means, you know, what that connection looks like, whether it be, you know, in a PowerPoint presentation or in a live chart. So tell us a little bit about your consulting group and the kind of work that you do there.
Right. Well, we seem to be attracting clients on in two broad categories. What I would call organizational network analysis. Will we come to a large enterprise using the proper protocols for privacy and security? We will access email servers, blog and wiki servers, and message boards, and we will build a graph that represents the actual structure of an enterprise. Many organizations above a certain size will build an org chart. In many ways, the org chart is not a map of the company, it's a map of the aspirations of management for how they want to understand their company. In many of those maps, for example, sales and marketing are on different parts of the tree, and what you want to know is, yes, but does sales talk to marketing? And in our approach, we can draw you a map that shows how much do any pairwise connections, any two groups, how much do they communicate? And from that, when you aggregate all of those pairs up, you get this collection of connection across the corporation. And these maps, I believe, have proven to be very insightful for figuring out, for example, where are the bottlenecks? Where are there parts of the company that have the longest path that they would have to travel to get to some other part of the company? And these maps turn out to be useful when you are HR or a organizational consultant trying to redesign the corporation. Or as is common, I hear this all the time, people will say, well, you know what we need to do here? We need to tear down silos. And my question typically is, well, so how siloed are you now? And there's usually a blank silence. People don't have a measure of how siloed they are. So we provide a silo score. We'll measure for both the corporation as a whole and for any individual or group within it a how connected or isolated are they measure. And this can be useful when management says our goal is to reduce the amount of siloing in the company. They do something, some initiative, and then we can actually measure the success or in some cases, the lack thereof, of that initiative. So that broadly is the scope of the enterprise scale social media analysis. There is this whole emerging space that has actually been going even faster, which is social media network analysis. And you could argue, well, wasn't that, what was it in the enterprise? Well, it's social media, that would be enterprise social media analysis. And then in contrast, we're looking at internet social media analysis. And when we look at internet social media analysis, and you can see some of these examples on my Flickr stream, we're building maps of topics, of brands, of candidates, of political parties, essentially anything that attracts conversation in social media. We've developed a tool that really streamlines the process of, let's say, going to Twitter and asking a question about the word global warming, or how it contrasts with a phrase like climate change, or the name of any brand or product or perhaps candidate. And we can see around these topics, groups of people have come together. Some are large crowds, some are small crowds, but that's just sort of a volume perspective. We also look at the connection of people within these crowds. So some topics are sparse. Nobody talks to anybody about that topic. They talk about the topic. They sort of shout it out into the wilderness, but they're not connected to each other. And you can see this, actually. I did a map of Iron Man 2. And you can imagine thousands of people walking out of a movie theater on a Friday night saying, I've just seen Iron Man 2. And the likelihood that they have any connection to one another is really low. And that characterizes a certain kind of social media topic, one that's sparse. In contrast, you look at something like, oh, well, Tea Party. And it turns out, first of all, that it's really dense, that there's a lot of people who say the word Tea Party, but almost all of them connect to somebody else who says the word Tea Party. And that further, these maps highlight the fact that there are two clusters under the word Tea Party, the dominant cluster, they are proponents of Tea Party, and a smaller cluster, a kind of shadow cluster, and they are Tea Party skeptics. Similarly, in global warming, we see a dominant cluster, and these are actually climate change skeptics. The dominant use of the phrase global warming is by people who don't believe it. The dominant use of the word climate change is by people who believe it. And in fact, there's only one major cluster within the, quote, climate change topic community in Twitter, in contrast to the two clusters that exist in the global warming topic. There's the skeptics and then a smaller group of scientifically oriented people who use the term, but I think what it means is that the scientific community has already lost control over the word global warming, and it's become one of those terms that now is really used by the opponents of that concept. So these kinds of observations come from mapping the social space around a certain discourse, and you could do this with Flickr or with the World Wide Web, or we also do a YouTube spigot. We call these sources of data, data spigots. And our goal is to expand that, to make it so that all the major dominant social media repositories that people care about are easy to grab a graph out of and look at. Now, I should note, and you made this point, that visualization and analytics are sometimes different. I'll note that because we have this spreadsheet model, you shoehorn this thing into Excel, you are also being given all of the numbers, these magic numbers, these scores, these network metrics like centrality, and we'll calculate the four flavors of centrality that are in wide use. These numbers help you actually make analytic choices. You can, for example, rank people in a uniform list. You can actually say who's the number one most, let's say, bridge person. We have a number for you. So combined, these tools give you some insight into a social space that was otherwise, I would argue, if not invisible, then its structure was certainly invisible. You could always go to a search engine and type in a keyword and see a bunch of messages. It was hard to tell how those messages were connected to each other prior to this.
Mm-hmm. One thing that this seems to, I don't know, for some reason, maybe it's just me, keeps coming up in my head is areas where either you're approached as, approached by an enterprise client, or perhaps there's another scenario, but that seems probably the most likely one, where you're asked to map something that seems ethically or morally
questionable.
Perplexing. Questionable. That's a good word.
Yeah. Well, that's very important.
Has that happened to you yet?
I haven't been asked to do it once I've pointed out that it's questionable.
Mm-hmm.
Or I guess let me put it this way. Many large enterprises are actually very savvy on this topic and don't want and will not violate the very many rules and regulations that govern the use of employee data, or for that matter, customer data. So particularly multinationals that are doing any business in the EU or certainly in Germany have much higher standards of legal use of personal data, higher levels of opt-in and informed consent, and higher levels of disclosure about the nature of the use of the data. I try to hold myself to those highest standards. I'm not going to do certain things to certain data. And largely my standards involve, similarly, informed consent, awareness, the ability of employees or the social media people who are being analyzed to gain access to the data and change it if necessary. So we prefer to publish our data, and we prefer, particularly on the enterprise side, to work very closely with privacy officers and compliance officers to ensure that we are not violating any of those ethical guidelines. Having said that, I will say it's still a somewhat muddy environment. It's still confusing, and there's a lot of variation from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And so my basic test is, if I were the employee in that data, if I was the person whose data is being analyzed in this way, how would I feel and react to the knowledge that it was being analyzed in this manner? Some mitigating steps we take, in some cases we will not look at individuals. We will only look at work groups. And then, because in some cases people are the only person in their work group, we will ignore work groups with fewer than 10 people in them to follow somewhat in line with the census, the idea that they collect a lot of detailed data, but they aggregated it only at the block or the neighborhood level so that it cannot be brought back identifiably to a particular individual. This balances some of the goals of the enterprise to have better insight into its own structure and the goals of the individual not to be surveilled without their consent.
So I guess, you know, a follow-on question to this is, you know, as a sociologist, where would you like, what are there institutions or other kind of goodwill efforts that you'd like to be able to take on, but you haven't been approached yet, or it's not really time? You know, I think about certain kinds of nonprofits. You talked about global warming. Some could argue that that's a, you know, one of those areas that could clearly use some help in terms of visualizing and seeing where differences and similarities occur, use of language, that sort of thing. Are there areas where you really would love to work in that you've not been able to, or, you know, it just hasn't happened yet?
Well, we haven't gotten into public health issues yet. I'd like to do that, and I've only just started to touch on things like political parties. I have a colleague in the Netherlands who keeps sending me requests for maps of political parties whose names I've honestly never heard of. I'm sorry to say, living in California, I don't read the Dutch political press as much as I should, I guess. But maps comparing, let's say, the VVD and the PVDA, I'm thinking I'm going PVDA next election, are intriguing in that we can start to see how different political parties structure themselves, but also public health. I think that the next time we have some kind of infectious disease outbreak, the amount of information that could flow through systems like Twitter might make the difference between the behavior changes that we need to stop the diffusion of that infection or not. And so I would really like to see the application of some of these tools to those areas, politics and public health.
And it seems like politics would be a ripe area since there's so much, at least discussion, about trying to use new types of, using social media in a better way. But, I mean, obviously this takes it to a whole new level. And, it's almost surprising that you haven't had the opportunity to do that yet. So for all those listening that are in the public health sector, give Mark a call. One thing I wanted to talk about is you do, quite a bit of speaking. I have tried to make a couple of your events and regretfully haven't. You have one coming up, you said June 1st.
That's right.
June 1st.
at Stanford University as part of the MediaX program there. MediaX puts on a series of workshops and presentations from some remarkable people related to the nature of new media. And sadly, I just missed Yuri Leskovich, a professor at Stanford, gave a talk on Monday, which I really wanted to see. So just an example of the caliber of people coming through there. And I'll be talking about how you can use these tools yourself to apply them to your questions and problems. And I'll note that there is a book coming out in the summer called Analyzing Social Media Networks with Node:XL, : Insights from a Connected World. That's Morgan Kaufman. They're a subsidiary of Elsevier.
Very cool.
And that part of our goal here is that it be that we want to be the distributor of fishing rods, not fish. We want to teach people how to use network science to their benefit. Having said that, in many cases, we've tried to teach people to fish and found out that what they really want is sushi. And we're happy to deliver sushi if that's what it kind of,
Big difference between the two. So what are some of the common questions? I'm really curious because, you know, when I think of sociology, you know, my mom says, you know, I'm a sociologist, and she is, and she counsels people and as a social worker and, you know, has this very one-on-one role communicating with individuals, whereas you're taking this, you know, your view on sociology has obviously gone down a very different path. And I'm just curious, first of all, you know, how it came to be, you know, how the interest, you know, was spurred, and then, you know, how you wrestle or are not connected to what people think of as the more general sociology community of counselors and social workers and people like that.
Well, I guess I'll note that the sociology community that I usually think of are the academic or research sociologists, who probably aren't the same group of people as the social work population. And
well, they're the people that are teaching they're the people teaching a lot of people that are out there practicing. But
right.
So I just want to make that connection, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, clear that they're being taught, but obviously your learnings go far beyond what most people I think learn.
I think it's just different. My training essentially is one in which sociology aspires to, and I bet some people would say has yet to realize this aspiration, but aspires to become essentially the physics of social relationships. It's a way of looking at the world as largely a vast pool of data with a vast amount of data with some interesting regularities within it. And we see our role as mining out observations about how people connect to one another in ways that are self-similar. In other words, some groups share certain structures and are different from yet other groups. So we come at it as a kind of social physicist, and I'm sure all the physicists listening are going, no, you're not. And I'd say, yeah, you're probably right, because, of course, humans are much more complicated than electrons. In that, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle notwithstanding, when you're looking at an electron, it doesn't tend to actively change its behavior in a way that's contrary to you just because it knows you're looking. In other words, if you tell people that I'm watching you, they may very well change their behavior. So physics and sociology are not the same domain, and it's hard to actually come up with law-like regularities in the social sciences in the same way that they've been very, very successful in doing in the physical sciences. Nonetheless, we're going through a phase change and a new era of computational social science is emerging. And this era of computational social science is made possible by the fact that now 3 and some billion people are interacting with one another on Earth through computation, and that could be SMS messages to one another, it could be Facebook, and it could be LinkedIn, it could be email, it could be Twitter, it could be all sorts of different things. But the thing that they have in common is that they leave machine-readable traces of human association. And that's the big change. You know, even 15, 20 years ago, the idea that the people you knew and interacted with would routinely leave a machine-readable trace was not that realistic. You would write a memo on a piece of paper and put it in an envelope, and it would go around the building. And it was very hard to trace who read that message and who forwarded it to somebody else. That's all trivial now. In contrast to the analog world, it's now very easy to trace this. And we're seeing all sorts of research projects looking at, for example, the diffusion of a tweet in Twitter as it's being retweeted through people's networks, and trying to look at what makes for a tweet that will be retweeted versus the tweets that just sort of lay there and never get replicated. So the big change is the availability of data. So much of what we do now leaves a trace. And pointing back in our conversation, that raises all sorts of ethical concerns, and we could and probably should have a debate about, well, what's the appropriate use of this data? What does informed consent really mean? Who should own it? Who should control it? Should it have a statute of limitations? Should it be destroyed at some point? What are the limits on integrating, let's say, Twitter data with data that I might have from credit card companies if I'm a large company and I'm buying up marketing and demographic data? There are many concerns, but we have moved into a new era where a resource is available to tell us about what it's like to be not an individual human, but a human within a society. What is the shape and dynamic of human groups? That is something that is now what we would call an empirical question. That's a computable question, and that's a big, big difference. So exploring that, I think, is the big differentiator. There's now a whole group of sociologists, and I'll point out that there is, of course, the American Sociological Association. Within that is a group called the Computers and Information Technology Section of the ASA. They're CITASA, CITASA.org, CITASA.org. So there are communities of scholarship out there. I'll just point out another one. The International Network for Social Network Analysis, that's INSNA.org, INSNA.org. These are good examples of scholarly communities that have formed now, in some cases for decades, around topics of largely what does it mean to be human in a world of computers, and largely in a world of computers that contain the behavior of other humans. So we're not really interested in computer-mediated interaction or human-computer interaction. That is a specialty in the computer sciences, human-computer interaction. I think what the sociologists are interested in is not HCI, but HCHI, which is human-computer-human interaction. I'm less concerned about how you interact with your laptop than I am with how you interact with people through your laptop. And that, to me, is the really interesting part of things right now.
So getting back to, I want to make sure that we kind of cover this, because I think it's such a far-reaching area that I would love to know what, you know, people that, you know, are able to attend your, you know, you do these workshops pretty frequently, for example, at Stanford and elsewhere. And I'm curious what it is that it are kind of common themes that you're asked about, and sort of how, you know, the kind of audience that you draw in the first place. You know, I think that both of those things are very interesting.
It's been increasingly diverse. Originally, most of my presentations were really to other academics and practitioners, and those really focus on the tools we've built and the data that we have and the unique features of both. So we will make presentations in which we say to people who already know about many, many other tools, why would you bother to use this tool? And part of our argument is this one's really much easier to use than others. This one's free, this one's open, and this one has special connections to social media, where most of the existing network tools are more challenging to use. They demand that you're a programmer, and they have no particular special features to help you get to Flickr or YouTube or things like that, or Twitter. So those presentations are a little different from what has started to emerge is audiences that are much more interested in this from a more generic background. They are brand managers. They are business managers. And their question is, first of all, just tell me what this network stuff is all about. Help me understand, wrap my mind around these sets of concepts. And so those presentations have shifted towards more introductory presentations around what do we mean by connection or tie or edge or node? What does it mean to be central? What does it mean to have in-degree or out-degree? And then having built a basic foundation of concepts, we can then turn to applying them to business critical areas, like what does it look like? What is the conversation about your product right now in social media? Who in that conversation seems to occupy a leadership position or one of two or three different kinds of locations in the graph that make them strategic? Who are those people? And we can then discuss what are good basic strategies for making social media meet business goals. And of course, the question then has to become, well, what business goals? But a typical one is, we have news, we want people to know about it. We have products, we want to describe them. We want people to be aware of this. We essentially want people to pay attention. And it turns out that people pay best attention not typically to the vendor or the brand, but to third parties who are seen to be more authentic in their commentary on a brand. So you don't really want to hear, let's say, what Mr. Jobs at Apple says about the iPad. Well, maybe you do. But it's going to be one of the third-party commentators who will tell you the real news that you might find is more critical, more trenchant, more actionable. Finding those people has become much easier. It's really trivial now. You draw the map of any topic, and the influential center people, the people who have different kinds of influence, very easy to identify. We usually use social network analysis metrics like centrality. There are four kinds. They have different uses depending on what you're trying, what kind of influence you're looking for. And we are able to help people guide them to these third parties who are talking about your product or business or service and might be the people you want to prioritize. Time is short. Resources are scarce. If 100,000 people are talking about your product, congratulations, but how are you going to hold a conversation with all of them? You might want the list of the top 20. We can help you, for yourself, figure out who are those top 20 and, in fact, offer you two or three different kinds of top to sort by, to bring perhaps different collections of 20 to the top that you might want to engage with directly in order to get this multiplier effect. Having engaged with them, they will engage with others, and that will reach the network as a whole, or at least that's the idea. Doesn't always work, but that's the idea.
Right. And so it's interesting to note that the speaking sessions that I've seen for you, and this is true of the MediaX event coming up at Stanford, are actually workshops. So my presumption is that you're actually showing people how to use Node.xl and create right there at the event something of value to them.
Well, one can only hope. Yes, that's the aspiration, that we'll take audience participation, call out your brand, and we'll build maps right then and there and try to identify people. In some cases, we find that the brand has already made deep engagement in a social media space, at which point we sometimes find that maybe their engagement hasn't yielded the behavior or the outcome they wanted. So, for example, we find often a crowding out effect where brands that have been very enthusiastic in engaging in social media do so too enthusiastically. And in doing so, block the emergence of these third-party brand champions that we've identified as being really important. And so under-engagement is a problem, but over-engagement can equally be a problem. And we're able to show some of that by doing things like ranking the top people within the community and saying, well, how many of them are actually employees versus third-party brand champions? We'll sometimes find that there are so many employee accounts active in a space that there doesn't seem to be any room in the conversation for your customers or your passionate enthusiasts to actually have any space in the conversation. So in some cases, counseling people not to, your goal is to be the host of the party, not the life of it. But yes, our model is a very hands-on one. As I mentioned, in some cases, what people in the end want is for us to do it for them, and that's fine. But I think in order to decide that you want somebody to do it for you, you must first understand what it is that you get. And essentially, we're map makers. We're social cartographers. We're creating a map of the social landscape. And I guess metaphorically, these maps are novel in the way that, let's say, satellite photography really was a revolution. There was aerial photography and, pictures from weather balloons, but until you got satellites in orbit, you never saw pictures of the planet as a whole. Now, I'm not claiming that our social network visualization tools capture these phenomena as a whole, because they're not. These are desktop tools, and many of these phenomena are internet-scale phenomena. And so what we're really providing is a way of slicing off a recent slice of that phenomena and looking at it, perhaps taking a slice every day or every hour even, for phenomena that are of great importance and are time fast-moving and time-sensitive. But these maps do share a quality in revealing something you haven't seen before. And once you get that vision, I think it helps guide people in their engagement with social media. And we are trying to teach people to fish. But we have that great sushi bar outside.
So one of the questions I have for you is you have this interesting, in terms of thinking about the journey that you've been on to get to where you are, and have the points of view that you do. Education is one of those things that is probably the first thing you think about when you think about somebody who's so immersed in an emerging area. And you do have an impressive background. You started out with a Bachelor's of Science in International Area Studies from Drexel University. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
So back in Philadelphia. Tell me about the evolution of your education and how that influenced your current career.
When I first went to college, my goal was to be a software developer, and it turned out I'm not very good at that. And so I'm not a computer scientist. And yet, when I sort of bounced off of being a scientist of algorithms, I realized that that wasn't what really attracted me to computing. It wasn't the computer. It was the people in those computers that really mattered to me. And I was just starting my undergraduate at a time when something called BitNet was starting to emerge as turning into the internet. I'm that old. And so before that, there were bulletin board systems, dial-up modems connecting PCs to one another using telephones. And this kind of CB radio of text, this invisible community that was forming online, really fascinated me. And when I backed away from computer science, I realized that there was this whole other discipline that was in many ways better suited to grasp this change. I mean, I could tell even in about 1985, 86, 87, that, wow, this was going to be big. And if I wasn't going to be the person writing the program, then what could I do to be part of this? And thankfully at Drexel, I have to say, for not a well-known university, a remarkably high-quality education with some really talented educators who showed me that sociology could be the path to understanding this phenomenon. I then went to Cambridge University in England to study social theory, and from there to UCLA. And at UCLA, perhaps the biggest influence on me was my advisor, sadly now the late Peter Kollek, who introduced me to the three traditions in sociology that have pretty much shaped my career from there on out. Peter was an exchange theory sociologist. He wanted to know how patterns of exchange emerged, and that led him to study collective action dilemmas, essentially the study of why we can't all just get along. Why is it that some groups work together productively and many don't? Related to that approach is social network analysis, a way of looking at the patterns of who trades with who shares with who helps who. And when you think about that in the abstract, it seems like, oh, yeah, people help each other. In the particular, some people help some people more, and some people help a lot of people, and some people help a few. And in other words, it can be quantified, it can be turned into a data structure, and it can be calculated on, it can be analyzed. So at UCLA, I was lucky enough to develop a set of really theoretical frameworks that I was able to turn back onto the internet. And with Peter, we wrote a book called Communities in Cyberspace that applied these models of collective action dilemmas, social network theory, and a third area called interactionist sociology, which is all about how you go about presenting yourself to others. How do you show people who you are in your address, in your behavior, or this is really the study of face. And in the current era, of course, we live in a world of not just face but Facebook, and so the online presentation of self became a perfect fit for these different models of interactionist sociology, social network analysis, and collective action dilemmas. Taken together, it helps us understand things like the creation of common good resources online. And you could argue that what makes the internet truly powerful is that it creates common goods. And a common good is anything that has value that you can access or take from without regard to how much you've given to its creation. And if you look around the internet, you'll find that we probably almost every day of the week make use of resources that were created by others and find great value in them and pay nothing for them and may never contribute to them. And so to get more particular, you know, how many people have read and gotten some value from Wikipedia, and how many people have edited even a single byte on any page ever? Well, the two populations are dramatically different in size. Millions upon millions of people have gotten value from Wikipedia. Thousands upon thousands of people have contributed. So it literally orders of magnitude difference in the size of these populations. So collective goods are fascinating things. In many ways, what you want are lots of collective goods, common goods, and that makes us all richer. The question is, how do you get them to succeed if you can take from them without giving? And studying systems like Wikipedia, and for that matter, message boards or Q&A forums, help forums, big archives of data, shared data observations. There's so many places where people come and give and are not necessarily paid, and other people can come and take without having made a contribution. So much so that you would think, well, that can't work. And you'd probably be right. Most of the time it fails. What's really interesting, though, are the rare cases in which it wildly succeeds, and I suspect Wikipedia is one of those examples, and it generates value that may be in the billions of dollars if you were able to quantify it. I don't know what the cash value of Wikipedia is or how you would measure that. But
they were able to raise $1 billion recently with just an appeal from the founder to help keep it going. So, I mean, that's pretty a pretty powerful testament to its worth to a lot of people. One thing I wanted to make sure that I got a chance to ask you about is the fact that you founded and managed the Community Technologies Group at Microsoft, which just seems amazing that you would found a group at Microsoft. Tell me a little bit about that.
All right, yeah. So for 10 years, from 1998 to 2008, I was in Redmond, Washington at Microsoft Research. And I was lucky enough to be able to bring together a group of people. We called ourselves the Community Technologies Group. And during that time, we built a series of prototype applications and internet services that explored this space. Notably, we created something called NetScan. NetScan was an accounting package for conversations. It's a way of looking at a system of threaded conversations. In this case, it was Usenet, but message boards or email lists are very similar. And we created a machine that essentially was an accounting software package for collections of conversation. And by that, I mean it would track how many messages from each person, whether or not that person's message got replied, attracted replies, and how many people replied to that person. It was a way of accounting for all the different kinds of participation and connection in a message board. And this accounting package, a lot like a financial accounting package, was used to monitor and plan engagement in social media in the same way that financial accounting is about monitoring and planning engagement in the other scarce resource, money. In this case, we were talking about human attention and labor, also a not scalable resource. They're not making more human attention. Humans have a finite amount of it. Computers keep getting faster and faster. We hear a lot about Moore's Law. The computers are going to double in speed and have and cost. There is no Moore's Law for humans. And I think once you're over 40, I think it goes the opposite direction. In fact, your ability to pay attention to things diminishes. So if attention and labor is scarce, how can we account for it, make sure it's going in the right direction? A social accounting package would be that. So we prototyped some of that. We applied some of those thoughts to desktop email. We created a prototype application. I believe it's still up at research.microsoft.com called SNARF. S-N-A-R-F, the Social Network and Relationship Finder. It ran over your personal email, and it would tell you who was most important to you. Now, you might think that that's a question that you don't need somebody else to answer for you, but this was a machine that would notice that, first of all, you got a lot of email, and the email that was at the top of the inbox wasn't necessarily the most important one. And in fact, a very simple accounting system for email could help re-rank your mail so that unread mail from people you had a relationship with went to the top rather than unread mail that just happened to arrive a few milliseconds ago. We have a word for that sort order, the ADD sort order. If it's new, it must be important. That's the attention deficit disorder, ADD sort order. The other order, the SNARF ordering, was based on the observation that, wow, if somebody sent you a lot of mail and you replied to it frequently, that's an indication of a relationship. And if you send them mail and they replied to that, that's an even stronger indication of a relationship. And so because of that, we could re-rank your mail and perhaps make you more productive so that you could decide, I can look at my mail the normal way. Well, go and download it. And, of course, other people have now started to productize these things. So there's Zobni, X-O-B-N-I, Zobni. That's inbox backwards. They're clever guys. And they've got a plug-in for Outlook that essentially productionized some of the concepts that we explored in SNARF. Another not desktop client approach is something called GIST, the letter J. I'm sorry, back up. letter G, G-I-S-T, gist.com, similarly ranks email based on the strength of your relationship. So, you know, we were in research. We were exploring things that weren't necessarily going to immediately jump into a cardboard box and be on a shelf. But those concepts now seem to be emerging in commercial software now a couple of years later. We also explored mobile social spaces with a handheld device that could read the barcodes on things and then allow you to create a threaded conversation around the physical object and then, of course, discover the threads that were hanging off of books and grocery objects and music just by clicking on it with your mobile phone. I'll note that now on the iPhone and the Android, there are many such applications. So we kind of explored those spaces early on, which, of course, is what research groups are supposed to do. So we did some of that. After about 10 years of that, though, I kind of wanted to make these things move into the real world more quickly and came to Silicon Valley to start the Connected Action Consulting Group. And still in collaboration with Microsoft, we've been producing the Node XL project with the generous support of Microsoft Research, who have allowed us to build a tool that, it's our aspiration anyway, will dramatically change the nature of network science by making it a lot easier for people who don't program to get their hands on graphs on networks and manipulate them and gain insight from them. So now I'm in the Valley and trying to ply my trade as a applied computational social scientist.
Well, we're almost out of time. I got to say, I am a huge fan of Microsoft Research, and what I think is so almost amusing, I guess, is that they really look at making computer science accessible and projects that make computer science work for you know, individuals. And you took a path away from computer science for a number of reasons. So it's always interesting to see how these journeys develop and you know, change and collide and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's a very it's very ripe discussion that we could go on and on about, but unfortunately we're just about out of time. So I want to thank you, Mark, so much. Dr. Mark A. Smith from Connected Action Consulting Group. I said it correctly. It took me a while.
Oh, thank you.
Who's their chief social scientist. If you go to jenniferlindsay.com, we have links to most of the things Mark was mentioning. And, of course, Mark, you're welcome to send us more links to add.
Sure.
And I want to thank you so much for being a part of the program and being a very articulate speaker in a field of science where a lot of times it's very hard to connect the dots.
Yeah, I mean, this is a new way of thinking, but other than its novelty, I think once people get over that hump, it is a way of opening your mind to seeing the world as a network. And, you know, there is that saying that if you give me a hammer, the world is a nail. For me, I have a network tool and the world is a graph. And I think you can create some interesting structures by pounding on that nail these days. So thank you so much for the opportunity to address your audience. Thank you.
Absolutely. And please keep me posted on all your goings-on, and I promise I will get to a workshop soon because this is just a fascinating area for me personally.
Well, thanks. Hope to see you there soon.
All right. Take care, Mark. Again, that was Dr. Mark Smith, Chief Social Scientist at Connected Action Consulting Group. And I want to thank you, the listener, for tuning into the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. If you like the show, we'd be delighted if you would friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio or rate us on iTunes. And be sure to tune in next week. We will have another influencer on 1 week from today, starting at 12 noon Pacific. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show, archives, and my work teaching at MediaBistro.com at JenniferLindsay.com, where you can also find links to the podcast that has just taken place. Have a great weekend.